Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we've got a guest that's going to talk about something we will call dendrochemistry. It's all about tree ring analysis and what tree ring analysis can do with us, because trees are living monuments to history. They've been there much longer than we have, some of them, and they have a story to tell because chemicals accumulate in each little ring for each year, and that tells us something about the environment. It tells us something about the social nature of society, and so a lot of interesting things. And our guest then is Paul Shepherd. He's from the University of Arizona, from the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research, one of the only ones, I think, in North America and one of the few in the world. So, Paul, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith. There are a couple of other prominent tree ring labs in America and several more across in the world. So we're not the only one, but we're the first and probably the biggest.
So tell me, why would the first tree ring analysis laboratory be in the middle of the Sonoran Desert?
Yes, the middle of the desert. We were founded by a fellow named Andrew Ellicott Douglas, who came to Arizona as an astronomer. And he was working for the other astronomer, a very famous guy named Percival Lowell. He wound up in Flagstaff, Douglas did, that is, and he founded the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff. And that was in the late 1890s, so a long time already. And while he was there in Flagstaff, he was sort of noticing for his own self that trees in sawmills and woodlots had ring variation that was held in common across trees, that the trees would have narrow rings at the same time as each other. He discerned for his own self, a very observant guy and logical thinker, that this probably was due to climate variation. And as an astronomer, he was mostly interested in climate variation and the role that solar variation might be playing in that. So he felt that trees would be able to extend a record of climate variation back into the past and potentially tell us about the sun. And the rest is history. From there, he started looking at tree rings more than at the sun itself to see if there was solar variation.
Right.
Yes, safer on the eyes.
So tell me, though, is just to finish that sort of thought, here is an astronomer, but he's a scientist. He's trained to observe.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes it's cloudy, even in Arizona.
Right.
So he's looking at trees instead, or tree rings in sawmills, and comes up with this concept that, hey, there's a story. There's a correlation between this tree from here and that tree. Did he, in fact, ever publish and find a connection between, for example, solar flares? And could he date solar flares from using tree rings?
Yes, he did publish. In his remarkable scientific career, which spans several decades, he had something like 75 to 80 publications. He published a lot, mostly in the later years of his life, and he died in the 1960s at the age of 95. So a very productive fellow and a long career. And many of his publications do assert and show a correlation between ring width variation and solar patterns, namely sunspot cycles. He was not actually able to make a definitive correlation between sunspots and tree rings, but it looked like he got close. And that research is still ongoing by others who follow him, trying to see if there really is a connection at the 11 or 22-year frequency between sunspots and tree rings. One thing he did discern from trees was that there might have been a lack of sunspots during the 1600s. This turned out to be true and is called now the Maunder minimum. So he was able to see
what minimum?
The Maunder minimum.
How do you spell that?
Maunder, M-A-U-N-D-E-R, named after the guy named Maunder who looked at records, say historical records from China, where they were doing observations of sunspots at the time, and they observed no sunspots for a good 60 to 70 years.
And from his tree ring observations, he'd made that as a sort of a hypothesis anyway.
Yes.
That's quite remarkable.
It is remarkable, and it was one of the great findings for him. And that was published in the early 20s, I think. So,
and that was using trees from Flagstaff area?
From Arizona. And he also went to California, looked at sequoias, obvious
the
trees to look at.
Right. Why is your laboratory for tree ring research not called the Douglas Laboratory? I mean, that seemed to me to be a very fitting tribute.
It could be, yes. Well, we all admire Douglas for his multidisciplinary science that he did. He's an astronomer dealing, basically inventing a subfield of tree biology. So we like him for that. It didn't become named for him. He founded the lab officially in 1937 when he was still at the peak of his career. And called it the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research at Arizona.
But why? I mean, you'd think the regents would like to recognize him.
Yeah, I guess.
Or is it because he's dead and he can't give them any money?
No more money at the moment. But we're just now making an annex building for the archive of wood that we have, which is enormous. We have a lot of wood. And we're going to call it the Bannister Archive. And Bannister is still alive, and he was Douglas's last graduate student.
Yeah.
So we have a connection with Douglas. Douglas died in the 60s, which I was alive at the time, so we overlapped by a few years.
How did you, Paul Shepard, become a scientist? Right. What was your driving force?
Well, I'm a forestry major, so you can call that a scientific field or not, but I became interested in trees as a result of being a Boy Scout. So I spent all of my formative teenage summers up at summer camp, and I lived with trees all the time. I became interested in forests and tree biology just by being there with it every summer of my teenage years. When it came time to go to college, I said, I want to be a forestry major so that I could perhaps spend all the rest of my life out in the woods. So I went to Humboldt State, California, famous forestry school there, and I could count a million board feet as well as the next person and basically grow a tree and cut it down and turn it into a coffee table. It turned out that that kind of forestry didn't interest me all that much, and at some point in my forestry training, I was pointed in the direction of tree ring science, tree ring analysis. And I found that to be much more engaging. All of a sudden, the depth of time was open to me, and I could look back in time and see how things were in the past. And the reason we want to do that is to see if conditions at present time are unusual or not. And I said, wow, this is really quite empowering. And so I switched all that million board feet production forestry stuff and went straight into dendrochronology.
How old are the oldest trees? I've read of 1,000, 3,000-year yew trees in England.
Right.
And where are the oldest trees and how old are they?
Well, the oldest trees we have found or have ever been found by dendrochronology are almost 5,000 years old. The oldest tree was up in what is now Great Basin National Park. It's had a number of rings, about 4,900 rings.
Where is that?
Great Basin. It's on
Salt Lake?
It's on the eastern side of Nevada, just at the Nevada-Utah border.
Okay.
It's now a national park. At the time this tree was found, it was a national forest, I think. And that tree was about 4,900 rings. And with some extrapolation to get to the pith or the center of the tree, we're projecting it to be about 5,000 rings, 5,000 years old.
And is this a short, fat one or a long, tall, thin one?
Yeah, this is a tree called the bristlecone pine. And as tree species go, it's neither tall nor very big. It's a very unusual growth pattern where most of the tree actually looks like it's dead already. But there's just a slight sliver of growth of bark on one side, and that just keeps on growing for practically ever. And there are many of these. The famous sites for this are in California in the White Mountains, just east of the Sierra Nevada, where trees there can typically be 4,500 years old.
Wow. So that is quite old.
Now, the other interesting thing about this wood is it's in an environment that's cold and dry, so the wood does not rot away very easily. And it's even if it's just sitting on the ground, it can stay there for thousands of years. So we have been finding dead pieces of wood that were living for 4,000 years but died 4,000 years ago. And by the magic, if you will, of cross-dating, whereby we match patterns of relatively wide and narrow rings, we can connect those dead pieces of wood with a living chronology. So now the full extent of the bristlecone chronology out of California is 8,700 years long.
Wow.
No individual tree lived that long, mind you.
No, I understand.
But now the entire chronology, including deadwood, goes back nearly to the Pleistocene ice.
Okay, so I mean that brings up all sorts of interesting questions. And really, we need a week of science studios to sort of get to some of these because it's a fascinating topic. What are the main thrusts of what you want to learn from tree rings?
Well, some people would say that my career has been lacking in focus because I actually have several different interests of mine that I like to satisfy with tree rings, and they do, in fact, overlap with much of dendrochronology. The benchmark application is climatology or the reconstruction of past climates so that we can see how present climates differ or are the same from the past. So I do and have dabbled in reconstructing rainfall and or temperature in the past for the last several hundred years, and I find that interesting and compelling. It's also very important work now to see how we're doing in this global warming stage. If we're in global warming, it is warming, but is it really warming more than it should in relative to the last 1,000 years?
And for this, then, you can look at different regions of the world.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Do you concentrate on the southwest United States in terms of, because there you've got a built-up record and lots of samples, or do you sometimes say, oh, I'm off to Novosibirsk or somewhere?
Yeah, I like to work in the Southwest. I've lived in the Tucson area for 20 years now, and the mountains of the Southwest offer a lot of dendrochronology possibilities, and there are interesting climate problems in the Southwest, including the bimodal rainfall, where we get some rainfall in winter and then a dry spell, and then some more rainfall in the summer. So the question now is, can we reconstruct rainfall for summer only in the Southwest? This would be very interesting because everyone wants to know, what is the monsoon going to do? And we might be able to speak to just the monsoon season if we can find the specific trees that would speak just to that season.
Well, have you, in fact, determined from any trees anywhere of other people from different areas, where in fact the monsoon is relatively a recent phenomenon. It hasn't always been so over the 3,000 or 9,000 years.
Well, based on other data, including pack rat midden analysis throughout the Holocene, it does appear like the monsoon initiated during the middle of the Holocene, so it has not been here forever.
And just remind us, when was the Holocene?
No, the Holocene is about the last 10,000 years. So within round off, it's about the last 10,000 years.
Okay, so all the trees you've ever seen will illustrate that there's been a monsoon.
Yeah, so it's not the trees showing us the monsoon from 8,000 or 5,000 years ago, but it's more like pack rat midden analysis.
Right.
And then the interpretation of those data saying that it probably didn't rain much in the summer in the early Holocene as it was warming up from the ice ages. So we still needed this sort of blocking mechanism or whatever the climatologist is going to be for the monsoons. And to get thermal lifting in the summer, that's what's important for getting our summer rainfall, is thermal lifting. So that didn't really show up in the Southwest.
You mean this is the heating of the earth and then updrafts bringing in stuff?
Right. It seems like that started in perhaps mid-Holocene, five to 8,000 ago.
So what are the techniques you use for studying this particular aspect of climate? What are you looking at in the tree ring?
Well, the major variable of interest in tree rings is the width of the ring. And simply speaking, a wide ring here in the Southwest will represent a year where there was ample or at least average rainfall. Conversely, a narrow ring will show a year that had below average rainfall, maybe no rainfall at all. So that very simple thing where you're looking at narrow rings, or lack of rainfall or drought, wide rings, ample or even above average rainfall. And then you see that for the last 500 years, you can come up with patterns including decadal scale frequency changes in drought, and they're very, very interesting.
Now, when you get a fat ring, that means there was lots of water.
Right.
Is the density in that ring much less than the density in a thin ring?
No, not usually. It's a good question. The cells that make up a ring are packed in there just about normal. And you see a ring, you look on a stump and you see these patterns of white rings and dark rings. Well, a pair of a light-colored band and a dark-colored band, that is the ring, a single year. A single year has both a light-colored and a dark-colored band. What we find for density changes are interesting is that the late part of the ring, the dark band, can be lighter or darker relative to others, depending on the temperature of the growing season of that year. It's not the rainfall so much, but the temperature. Very interesting associations. So, for example,
this is colorimetric.
Color. It could be color or also just pure density with grams per unit volume. Yeah, sure. And light-colored late wood comes during rings years that are relatively cool during the growing season. So we could actually reconstruct independently whether it was rainy in the winter of one year and warm during the growing season of that following year, independently.
And this is all accepted. This isn't just hypothesized now. Everybody in the field agrees that that's a tool for getting that type of very precise climatological information.
Sure. These kinds of techniques have been around for decades, and they've been practiced especially in Europe and the United States a long time. So no question there. And we find it relatively logical and intuitive that a wide ring would be a wet year, and so that's pretty simple to follow into.
Okay, so that's a pretty, how would I put it, simple. I mean, all you need is a good ruler or some calculation of length. But we call this dendrochemistry.
Right.
So there must be other techniques that are used, because in chemistry we do a lot more than just measure length.
Right. So dendrochemistry would be considered a separate sub-discipline of dendrochronology, where the measurement variable of interest is an element concentration right in the wood itself. So you date the wood with your cross-dating, and then you chunk off with a chisel maybe the ring period from 1950 to 54, some five-year period. You send that off to a chemistry lab, and then they do their thing with it, and they come back with a report that say in this chunk of wood you have some parts per billion or some parts per million of an element of interest. For example, lead or cadmium or any other metal of interest, or even other things of interest like potassium and magnesium, which would be considered force nutritional elements that are important. And the question then becomes, has that concentration changed through time, and is there some change in the environment chemically that we might be interested in? And so you can just look at the actual concentrations of elements in rings, in the wood of the rings, and see if things have changed chemically.
Have you done much of that type of work?
I've done work for the last 5 years on this in various different applications. I would say I've done some. I'm not really the leader in that, but it's become so interesting, and I have different applications going, including here in El Paso.
We'll be back in one moment. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm here with Paul Shepard from the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research at the University of Arizona. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel.
Many hikers and mountain climbers say their love of the sport is a spiritual experience that clears the mind. But that analogy may be a bit too real. A new study finds high-altitude mountain climbing alters the brain.
Magnetic resonance images, or MRIs, were done on 35 mountain climbers, 12 professionals, and 23 amateurs. They all recently attempted high-altitude climbs, including Mount Everest, the world's highest peak. Virtually everyone who climbed Everest showed signs of brain damage, and many of the others as well.
The MRI revealed microhemorrhages in the brain. The worst cases were climbers who had suffered high-altitude cerebral edema. This happens when capillaries in the brain leak, causing dangerous swelling. A quick fix is rapidly descending the mountain or using a hyperbaric chamber.
Scientists had always thought once a climber recovered, the brain healed. But the new study suggests the damage is permanent and revealed even climbers of lesser peaks who show no signs of altitude sickness had irregular MRIs.
The scans show an enlargement of the Virchow-Robin spaces, or VR spaces. These spaces surround blood vessels that drain brain fluid and communicate with the lymph system. Usually, the enlargement of VR spaces happens in the elderly, but not young people, such as the mountain climbers in this study.
3 years after the initial MRI, the same climbers who had made no expeditions in the interim still had the same brain scans, suggesting the damage is permanent.
Scientists will need to study a greater number of climbers to conclude whether high-altitude mountaineering leads to long-term brain damage and diseases such as Alzheimer's.
As the sport gains popularity, climbers should know the full risks. We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Well, welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Paul Shepard from the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research, University of Arizona. So you've got into the more chemical analysis. And what particular foci do you have? I mean, are there particular issues that you want to look at? Or is it just whenever somebody comes to you and says, hey, is it an interesting set of samples? How does it work?
It could work that way. And a lot of people have approached us to say, can tree rings speak to a chemical incident that we think we see here in our little site? And so it can be that simple. But there are actually other driving questions that are always out there. One of my particular interests is in the field of geomorphology, specifically with volcanic eruptions. I'm interested in dating eruptions of volcanoes, especially if their eruption history is not well known for the past several hundred years. For example, in the Oregon and Washington Cascades, you've got all those large volcanoes, those stratovolcanoes, and one of them is especially by Portland.
Sorry, a stratovolcano. Explain that.
Stratovolcano is the big ones. Those big ones, like Mount St. Helens.
Okay.
Yeah, your big ones. And they cause large explosive eruptions. And in 1980, Mount St. Helens is a good example of that for anyone who was alive at the time. No one can forget that in the United States. By contrast, I also study cinder cones, which would be the very small brother of the stratocones. Cinder cones would occupy just a minor fraction of the campus of UTEP, for example. Well, maybe the entire campus of UTEP. That's how big they are, very, right. Very small. And they're not going to impact hardly anything.
But just for the audience, I would tell you that our campus is not as small as that might imply. We're really hundreds of acres, but carry on.
Yeah, so I went up to Mount Hood, for example, the large stratovolcano right outside of Portland, Oregon, to look for evidence of the last major eruption of Mount Hood. They're very interested in knowing, perhaps projecting when the next eruption of Mount Hood might occur, because it would cause quite the issues for Portland. Mount Hood is close to Portland. Mount Hood is due to blow sometime. It still has a sharp peak to it, and many other Cascade volcanoes don't. So it's going to erupt at some point in time in the future. It's almost certain for that. The question is, when was the last time? Based on other tree ring records, the last time it erupted might have been in the late 1700s, the 1790s, for example, 1780s maybe. And so based on that, we felt like we had a chance to look for that eruption using dendrochemistry. The ash fallout of these things could be elevated in typical elements like sulfur and phosphorus. And those would be maintained in the tree rings of trees that were receiving ash but not killed outright by the eruption. So all you have to do is go find trees that predate the eruption and are still growing there now. So some 200 to 300-year-old tree. That's easy in Oregon. Lots of those. And you have to get far enough away from Mount Hood to find trees that got ash but survived the eruption. That's also pretty easy. There are plenty of those trees. Then you have to go away from Mount Hood to find trees that were never affected by any of the ash fall and make a comparison. So we did just exactly that, and we measured tree rings in the late 1700s, and we found an increase in rings beginning in 1781 of the element phosphorus.
That's the clue.
That's the signature, if you will, of the eruption. And it was at 1781. Based on other tree ring evidence, which includes trees that were killed by the eruption, and so their last terminal ring was 1781, it is thought that the eruption was, in fact, 1781. It was still kind of equivocal, and we wanted to use a separate line of evidence to see if 1781 was correct. Dendrochemistry seems to be confirming that 1781, there was an increase, nearly a permanent increase in phosphorus in the rings of trees that were in the ashfall. By comparison, trees that were well away from the ashfall from that time show no change in phosphorus.
Okay, so then there's a couple of points you made there. One is that, okay, there's a sudden occurrence of, in this case, an eruption of a volcano, spews out lots of things. One of the more mobile of those things is phosphorus.
Yes.
You can see it being uptaken by the tree, but then you made that little interesting sort of extra addendum on a permanent basis.
Yes.
So two things there. One is there must be an immediate uptake, which one tends to think naively, not knowing anything about trees, that this is through the leaves, all right, or the foliage, or maybe the bark, but we can address that. And then there's a longer period of time when that material, the ash, is on the ground, and now the phosphorus is going in through the root system.
Right.
So that must make life very complicated for you.
Yeah, potentially. I didn't mean to say it was permanent all the way to present, for
no,
example.
No, but I mean 10, 15 years.
Yeah, it certainly lasted for a long time. I would say that if phosphorus is being injected into the ecosystem as a result of ash fall from an eruption, then that's going to be present in the soil for a good number of years, probably 2 or 3 decades. The trees, therefore, should reflect that, at least that amount of time.
Right.
And it looks like the ones that we sampled right in the ashfall are showing that. Maybe sooner or later the phosphorus will wear out, if you will,
right,
and basically go back down to background levels.
But my point, though, is that there's two ways in which these chemicals can enter into the tree ring.
Right.
One is through air, if you like, through absorption on leaves, etc.
Right.
And the other is through a root system.
Right. So as a good old-fashioned forestry major, I got to say that the function of roots is to take things up from the soil. That's its job. And so anything that comes along in the soil moisture stream is going to get into the tree. Phosphorus should get into the tree through the root system. That's the primary function of the root system, in addition to holding the tree in the ground in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the leaf situation, for coming in through the leaves, elements will have to cross and go against a gradient. The gradient for moisture is always to the outside, from the leaf to the outside for moisture. And about the only thing that really goes against that gradient is carbon dioxide. Trees breathe in carbon dioxide through the holes in their leaves called stomata. So they do that, but that's a gas. To think that an actual element which has mass and a solid element is going to get through that gradient is a little hard to believe. Sure, it probably happens to some degree, but I don't think it's the major intake of elements through leaves. And then you've got the
bark. How then would you explain the sort of rapid increase in the same year?
Well, if you add fertilizer to a garden tree, you'll get an increase in an effect of that same year.
So, okay,
if you're pouring fertilizer on a garden, you'll get an impact almost instantly right on the soil.
Even in the winter when it's dormant?
Or if you just wait till the next growing season,
yeah,
sure.
Right.
Sure. You should see something on the resolution of a year or two.
I mean, that whole business of root systems taking up metals, for example,
right,
that spawned a whole environmental program, phytoremediation.
Yes, yes.
Where if you've got a field full of chromium, I don't know if this is a good example.
Yeah, it is.
You plant trees, the tree root system takes up the chromium.
Right.
You cut the tree. Now you've got a nice virgin soil.
Exactly.
That's the theory.
That's the theory. And it seems to work in some places where people just plant trees on a contaminated site,
right,
and thereby clean it up, cut the trees out, and start over. It seems remarkable, but it's actually kind of green, you know, in this day and age of green.
No, absolutely. It sounds pretty good, except you've got to wait a long time.
Right.
I mean, when they came through El Paso, EPA came about 5 years ago and cleaned up lots of gardens because of some excess lead and maybe arsenic. And all they did is come in with great big bulldozers and take away the soil and I don't know where they put it and bring in new soil. That only took, well, for my garden, it only took about a week. So it's quicker than growing the trees.
Right.
Earthquakes. No, sorry, back off. You mentioned that you can pinpoint things like volcanic eruptions.
Right.
What about things like earthquakes? Is there anything you can say about earthquake detection?
Yes. Funny you should ask. Yes. I've had the good fortune, to date and thereby discover a previously unknown earthquake for the famous San Andreas system down in Southern California.
perhaps the most studied system anywhere.
Highly studied, yes.
Right.
The thing in tree rings is that we can date and discover practically anything that disturbs the growth of trees, and obviously earthquakes can do that. Trees growing right on the fault line in San Andreas, when there's a major eruption and some displacement of the fault structure by a number of meters, for example, as much as 8 to 10 meters in the southern San Andreas, that's a long ways for a tree to move. And root systems are damaged and branches are pitched off and everything, the tree looks like a mess. It's not necessarily killed, but it's definitely changed. And what we would expect to see in that case then is some change in the ring growth. And sure enough, trees near Los Angeles, up in the mountains, the local mountains of Los Angeles and San Bernardino National Forest, there are trees that showed an abrupt change in between 1812 and 1813 that had not been seen before, not explained before, and we think that that was a result of a large earthquake at that time, probably between the growing seasons of 1812 and 1813.
Well, what did you see?
We saw mostly an abrupt decrease in ring growth and then a decades-long recovery. So back in Southern California, you know, when it gets dry, there's a decrease in ring width. That's easy. But the next year, it's probably going to rain. So most droughts aren't going to last for decades. They'll last some number of years and then come back to normal. That isn't what we saw on these trees. We saw an abrupt decrease down to practically nothing, and then decades, 5 to 6 decades of recovery.
Yeah.
This does not strike us as climate. This strikes us as something else. And these trees were growing right in the fault line based on the maps that we had at the time, which were very good. And you can actually see expressions of the fault in the field.
Do they call it now the Shepherd Earthquake?
The Shepherd Earthquake. Well, I was the research tech on that. So if they called it anything, it would be named after my boss, who was Gordon Jacoby, a great, great geomorphologist and a great dendrochronologist. I really enjoyed working with him. And the two of us were out there in November of 87, coring trees, trying to find the precursor to the last known earthquake, which was 1857. That was when people were living there, and they shook around in 1857, and that was the last known earthquake in that spot. The question was, when's the precursor to that? And if you find the precursor, then you can start to establish a return interval for projections into the future. Everyone was looking in the early 1700s, late 1600s in order to find that precursor. We didn't see anything in the trees at that time. But I was the research technician involved with actually doing the dating, and I said, hey, wait a minute, I'm seeing something here in 1812, 1813. But I only saw it in the first case in one tree, and one tree is not enough. The second trip we went out, we went to a tree right in the fault, and my boss, Gordon, gave me the core from that tree, and I saw instantly out in the field that it was 1812.
That's a moment of recognition.
It is a moment of discovery that I'll never forget, and I wish everyone could have a moment of discovery where you know something that no one else in the world knows, and it's an important thing.
Right.
So we came up with this discovery of 1812. That now ruins the regularity of earthquakes for the southern San Andreas, because 1857 to present is 150 years, but 1857 back to 1812 is only 45 years, so it doesn't look very regular.
And when was published, did the insurance rates for a property go up in that area?
Yes, it's funny, you should ask, because there were people living there at the time, and their houses are right on the fault. I am telling you, they are at ground zero, and the next one hits, their houses will be ruined. And in fact, there's a line painted in the Forest Service building where the fault will go. That building will be sheared in half.
Jeez. It's been a fascinating program, Paul. I'm so happy that we managed to sort of delve into at least the first ring of chemistry and dendrochemistry. And thank you very much for being here.
You're very welcome, Keith. Thanks for having me.
And I'd like to thank Norma Martinez, who's firmly rooted over there producing this program year after year. And we'll be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Robert Resendez is the new public health director over the City of El Paso's Department of Public Health. He was part of a national search that included interview panels with internal and external community stakeholders. Resendez comes to El Paso with 3 decades of public health and private sector experience. Read more at Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.